Grant. It's about, far more so, about the whole landscape of spinal cord injury today, from its history through clinical care, through innovations in science, and through the importance of engaging all stakeholders, scientists, researchers, clinicians, patients, in the spinal cord injury, whether we're in person, science and ethics about the central nervous system, to the public, to patients, in an informal and really discursive sort of way. So our panelists will speak only briefly, and we will leave plenty of time for this open discussion with our audience who are here today with us. Our goal through community conversations is to conduct research that directly aligns human values with neuroscience, the science of the central nervous system. And we're just delighted to partner. Our schedule for the next 85 minutes or so is as follows. We have four wonderful panelists who I will introduce in just a moment. We will hear about the history of spinal cord injury treatment, advances in clinical care, new experimental approaches to spinal cord injury repair, and insights into engaging people with lived experience in the spinal cord injury journey. They will each have under 7 minutes to present, and they're going to cover their topics in dutifully in that amount of time. So you can imagine how excited they are and challenged they are to be sharing their knowledge with you in such a short amount of time. But as I mentioned, we really want to privilege the time to speak and engage with all of you who have joined us. So without further ado, it's my great pleasure and with great gratitude that I introduce Dr. Karim Fahoud, who's Professor and Canada Research Chair for Spinal Cord Injury at the Department of Physical Therapy in the Faculty of Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Alberta. He's a member of the Neuroscience and Mental Health Institute and co-director and editor of the Open Data Commons Spinal Cord Injury. His research focuses on rewiring neuronal circuits after spinal cord injury, and his work promotes neuroplasticity, regeneration of injured nerve tissue, with the ultimate goal of promoting functional recovery. Dr. Fu, thank you so much for being here with us. Dr. Townsend is a colleague of mine for many, many years now here in Vancouver. She's clinical professor in the Division of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation and associate head of education in the Department of Medicine. Her expertise is in spinal cord injury, and she also studies ventilator dependency resulting from paralysis of the diaphragm. She's an investigator at the International Collaboration on Repair Discoveries and is an attending physician on the Spinal Cord Injury Rehabilitation Program at GF Strong Rehabilitation Center. Dr. Townsend, thank you for taking time out of your busy clinical schedule to be with us. Dr. Madden, John Madden, is Director of Advanced Materials and Process Engineering Laboratory and Professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at UBC. His lab does research on actuators, sensors, and other innovative devices based on smart materials. Much of Dr. Madden's research combines electrochemistry and emerging materials to explore new applications, fabrication processes, and devices. He is indeed principal investigator of the new Mend the Gap grant, and leading an international team that seeks to repair the spinal cord after injury. And I might point out that Dr. Madden also has a recent publication in Science, which is a milestone for those of us in the research community. Congratulations on that success, Dr. Madden. And Barry Monroe, Mr. Monroe, is Chief Development Officer of the Canadian and American Spinal Research Organization, which was established in 1984 to fund targeted research to maximize functional recovery and cure paralysis caused by spinal cord injury. He also currently holds the position of treasurer for the North American Spinal Cord Injury Consortium, which is a community-led organization with the mission of bringing unified achievements in research, care, cure, and policy by supporting collaborative efforts across the spinal cord injury community. He is a lawyer by trade, practiced personal injury lawyer for over 10 years. He is a person with quadriplegia who sustained a spinal cord injury in 1987 and has been active as an active advocate in spinal cord injury research for over 30 years. He is also a valued member of the Ethics and Knowledge Translation counsel for the Mend the Gap project. So with no further ado, I would like to invite Dr. Fuad to talk about the history of spinal cord injury treatment and development. Thank you all again for being here with us. Dr. Fuad.
Good. Hi, everyone. Nice to kind of see you. So I'm charged to talk about 30 years of research. I'm going to narrow the research down to the repair of the spinal cord because there's a field of neuroprotection, which is a huge area on its own, but that would be too much. So when it comes to repair, I think where it all started is when people wondered why in the periphery, so let's say in your arm or your legs, neurons can regenerate, but they don't in the spinal cord, right? Many people heard the stories that, you know, fancy hand surgeons, they can't put a hand back that got maybe injured and maybe even cut off by a saw or something. You hear these stories and the neurons can somehow grow back because the hand can be used at the end again. Maybe not perfectly as before, but pretty impressive. So why is that, right? That was a big question. And that was addressed many, many years ago. And in the group from Albert Aguayo, actually in Montreal, where they said, well, let's just try whether it's something in the nerve or whether it's the nerve cells in the spinal cord that do not grow. So they took a piece of nerve from an arm or hand and put it into the spinal cord after an injury. And what they found is that actually nerve cells in the spinal cord can grow into this piece of nerve. So that's like mind-boggling. Neurons can actually grow. And from there, it went pretty quick that people said, okay, we just have to give neurons something that they like to grow on. And that's where a large field started, where people were grafting cells that were allowing growth into the spinal cord. And there are many, many cell types and famous cells, for example, stem cells were used for that. And so then these cells were given not just to form a bridge that neurons could grow on, but also to replace cells that were lost by a spinal cord injury, or even, you know, form neurons and then offer a relay for injured cells. But one thing became very clear when people saw that neurons can grow, they looked for the reasons why they don't in the spinal cord. And it was thought that, you know, if we find the reason why they don't grow in the spinal cord, then we can just neutralize that reason and we have a treatment. That was a brilliant idea. But the problem was that people found more and more reasons why nerve cells can't grow. And there are many of them. There's a scar around the injury. There are growth inhibitory factors. Neurons in adult mammalians, they just seem to not like to grow too much anymore anyway. And so it became very clear that if we really want to have a powerful treatment, we need to combine different approaches and neutralize different factors together to get a really powerful treatment. And so this field has slowly evolved. And in the same time, people started to kind of look a little bit at, well, if there is no regeneration, why do people recover to a certain degree? Why can they? And the same was in labs, in animal models, there's a certain amount of recovery. So people started to also learn a little bit about what we call neuroplasticity. It's the reaction of the nervous system to rearrange after an injury. So everything that's spared can somehow rewire and get kind of reutilized. And so that became a totally different field where people said, oh, you know, if we promote plasticity, maybe that's how we can help people. Interestingly enough, these two fields came back together because many factors that help in the neuroplasticity are also important for the regeneration when we really want to regrow axons. So this is how we came here. And I would say the latest things that really added to the field are, well, thanks to technological advances. So for example, one big thing is now we can actually look at different cells and how their genetic expression changes. So basically, how do these cells behave differently? We can really look at the little genes and see how they are basically expressed or read. And And that showed us a lot of things, how, you know, different neurons respond to an injury. And we also learned that there are actually many more cells than just nerve cells. We always talk about nerve cells, but comes out that other cells also play a big, big role in this. And we have now the chance to look at all these cells and look at this big concerto of different cells and factors that all play together after an injury. And I think that's a big step where we move forward. And then bioengineering also made huge leaps, and they're now able to help us to build, you know, solutions for regeneration of the spinal cord, to build bridges. And I think this is what we're going to hear more about from Dr. Madden. How did I do for time? I don't even know.
It was brilliant.
Woo-hoo!
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Fahoud. Let's go on to Dr. Townsend to bring us a little bit up to date on what's new and maybe what's old in clinical care in this space.
Yeah, thanks, Judy. And that is a lot of what I wanted to talk about, what's new and what's old. So as Dr. Ellis mentioned, I am a rehabilitation medicine clinician. I'm a physician who looks after people who are living with spinal cord injuries. And I see patients all the way from acute care right after they've been injured in the hospital through to rehabilitation at GF Strong, which is our rehab center here in Vancouver, and then back out into the community when people are back to living in the community and reintegrating into their lives. And I think one of the things I was thinking about as I was thinking about this topic was the fact that, you know, in the past 25 years since I've been doing this, there have been some advances in clinical care, absolutely. But we haven't had, you know, they've been incremental. They're step by step, and we bring things together and we get excited, and there's lots of exciting things happening. But a lot of what I'm doing today is similar to what I did when I first graduated. So we're very fortunate here in Canada, and particularly, you know, because we punch way above our weight when it comes to spinal cord injury care and spinal cord injury research. And I think one of the things that we do very well and that has changed since I first started is how quickly we see patients getting their surgery and getting mobilized. So when I first started training, people would be in bed for weeks on end until they could start to mobilize. And now surgery happens very quickly if they need surgery. And if surgery isn't going to be done, then we get patients mobilized very quickly and we get them active and starting in their rehabilitation treatment. We've also done a better job of integrating our systems. So our surgeons talk to our rehabilitation specialists and talk to our teams, and we've got a better continuum and integration of care. And those transitions, I think, are smoother and make a difference. We've been fortunate in Canada to have been able to establish the Rick Hansen Registry, particularly for people living with traumatic spinal cord injuries. But that's a way for us to document who's living with spinal cord injury. What does that look like? We follow up with patients over time, and it's going to be an opportunity for us down the road, if there are interventions that can be done, to identify people who may be able to benefit from those interventions. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the other clinical advances that have happened. So as Judy mentioned, one of my areas of interest is ventilator dependency. So when people have spinal cord injuries, there's an interruption in the signal from the brain out to the body. And that interruption happens in the spinal cord. And depending on where that interruption happens, how high in the spinal cord it happens, they may not be able to breathe independently or on their own. So if patients have very high injuries at C3, C4, C5 up in the neck, which is where we call those, they may not have an intact nerve, the phrenic nerve that goes to their diaphragm. And one of the things one of the advances we've made is that when I first started, we had few options for people who were on ventilators and needed assistance breathing. We now have diaphragmatic pacemakers. And so when I first started, you could do a phrenic nerve pacemaker, but you had to crack open a chest and do a thoracotomy, and it was very risky and there were lots of complications. But Dr. Ray Anders out of Cleveland Clinic has developed a diaphragmatic pacemaker that can be inserted endoscopically. And so it's very minor surgery. It's just a slight procedure. The patients can go home at the end of the day. And then we can start stimulating their diaphragm directly and integrating that. And people can start to breathe they're not breathing on their own. It's a pacemaker that is helping them breathe, but they can get off the ventilator. So that's a huge advance just in my area that I take, where I take care of patients. And I think it shows what happens when we bring together the biomedical engineers. My daughter's a biomedical engineering student, so I've got to give a plug to our biomedical engineers. When we bring together our surgeons, when we bring together our rehabilitation doctors, our respiratory therapists, our physiotherapists, our occupational therapists, all of our team members, our nursing and social work. And I think that's what I really wanted to emphasize, is that no matter what happens in terms of advances in clinical care, we're going to need rehabilitation. It's not going to be simply give a pill or do a device. We're going to need to be able to have rehabilitation specialists, team members working together and working with patients to individualize and personalize how that treatment is delivered. So at the end of the day, we're going to have lots of exciting news about advances and potential treatments, but we need to make sure that it's a person who's receiving those treatments. Their priorities may not be the same as our priorities. We have to individualize that, and we have to make sure that we've got a team in place ready for them. There you go, Judy. 5 minutes.
Also brilliant. Thank you so much. I see questions already coming in the chat, so please do bring them on. I'm already monitoring. It's fantastic. And I'm going to invite Dr. Madden now to speak about some innovations in spinal cord injury repair. And I know that he also has a special treat for us. We normally do not allow PowerPoint presentations in these community conversations. We try to keep them conversational. But he has a wonderful, very short video to share with us that I think everybody will really benefit from. So over to you, John.
Thank you, Judy, and great to be talking to you all and to tell you about a new project that we've just launched. We're now in the first just over 6 months of a six-year, $24 million international project. We have 28 professors from around the world, from 11 universities. About half of the investigators are in Canada, or actually about two-thirds are in Canada, also in Germany, Australia, Sweden, US. And our goal is to do what Karim was describing, which is to demonstrate regeneration in the spinal cord. So can we get those connections to regrow? And as Karim outlined, there are a lot of pieces that have to be addressed. And so what we're hoping by the end of 6 years, we can show that this should be possible. And then from there, build on that towards showing that it can be possible in a person. And some of the pieces we've talked about, we need to create the conditions in which a neuron wants to regrow. So that means, putting in different drugs locally to make that happen, create the right environment. We need to also guide the neurons, and I'll show you how we're going to do that. That involves some engineering. We need to get rid of some of the scarring that blocks the growth and the site of injury. We need to get into the area without doing more damage than we came to repair. This is really important. And we need to understand and make sure that our solution is something that people actually want and that is reasonable to actually try on people before we know for sure it's going to work on them. So there are a lot of questions that have to be answered. And then after that, we also, and along with that, we need to figure out the rehabilitation. So let me show you a brief video of our approach, if everything works out here. And so what you're going to see, and I'll just go into presentation mode, hopefully. So what you're seeing here is a back view, an artist's rendition of all the signals going down. And now these white bulbous lines are representations of axons, which are way larger than they truly are. They're much smaller than a hair. And we've just created an injury. And so these injuries can be you know, several centimeters across due to motor vehicle accidents, sports accidents, falling off ladders, gunshot wounds, lots of different potential causes. Normally, our spine is our spinal cord or our spine protects us, but sometimes it fails. And then we create an injury similar to what's shown here, and there's scarring surrounding it. And so the axons, even if they try to regrow, they're blocked by scarring and the environment. Even if they penetrate in, they have nothing to grow on. So what we're doing is injecting via a needle these tiny rods. Each rod in length is less than the diameter of a hair. And we align them using a magnetic field. And then by reducing the scarring, we then hope to get these connections to start regrowing in a directed fashion across the region and forming connections at the other side. So this is our hope. We're still, there's still a lot of research that has to be done to put all this together. And at the end of this, we hope to show that this is possible. As I said, we have a team, a large international team. We also have partners, including some who, so many of our team are actually on the call today. And we also have some of our partners, Praxis Spinal Cord Institute, based in Vancouver, but an international institute, Rick Hansen Foundation, and Spinal Cord Injury BC are our main partners. And together, we are then putting to, we've got materials experts led by Laura de la Porte, who's in Germany. What she has shown is that she can create these tiny little rods that are magnetically aligned and that the nerves can grow along them. The axons can grow along them. Now what we're doing is trying a whole range of different approaches to see which ones work best. How do we then diminish scarring? How do we then create the right environments? How do we deliver drugs? And a big part of the project is another engineering part, which is how do we deliver the materials into the spinal cord without doing damage? So there, for that, we're using image-guided robotic surgery. And so we have members of the team who are expert with expertise in all these different areas coming together to try and solve or make an advance in an area that has been proven to be extremely challenging. So thank you.
Another brilliant presentation. Barry Monroe, the bar is set very high for you, but we're ready and we're excited to hear from you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having us on and letting me have the opportunity to speak to everybody today. As Judy said earlier, I'm a spinal cord injury person. I've had my injury 35 years ago. So I've been, frankly, a front seat witness to watching the evolution of research. And from the dark days when we weren't allowed to talk about any type of restorative research, to the point of great presentations, just like Dr. Madden just gave us there, we are in an interesting time. And yet we're not quite there yet when it comes to really the empowerment of the people with lived experience and the role that we should play in research. In fact, we're late to the game when it comes to spinal cord injury research. Many other indications and conditions like Parkinson's, ALS, Alzheimer's, muscular sclerosis, they have patient advocates. I use that word patient, excuse me, but that's sort of the institutional name, but they have people with lived experience that are actually involved from start to finish in research in terms of their influence. You cannot replace the expertise that somebody has with a spinal cord injury and knowing about spinal cord injury. And unfortunately, some of that information has been lost or never translated into the lab and into the great people that are doing fantastic work in research, where this would take it to the next level. And really what we're doing right now with this Canadian Spinal Research Organization and really working with the North American SCI Consortium, which, by the way, was born in theory out of the Praxis conference in 2016, which is great and kind of a nice plug for Made in Canada story, where we've come together and we've decided to create a resource that would empower people with spinal cord injuries to be more active advocates in research. Frankly, it wasn't hard to start putting together the concept because many other conditions, like I said before, have already done that. In fact, I think the early leaders were breast cancer survivors, where they were raising all this money for research, but they really had no input on research. And I want to go back to what Andrea said earlier, that we need to listen to the priorities of the people with spinal cord injuries as we move forward with profession and, you know, in terms of treatment and clinicians and how we go forward. Having us at the table at the beginning can increase the value of the research, can make it more effective, it can be easily translated better, and frankly, it saves money. It's the fact is that the proof is in the pudding that in certain conditions where they've involved the people with lived experience in the research, they've had a much better success rate in recruitment for clinical trials, and that and they did it in record time and did it more efficiently. Why? Because they asked the people that know. So what we're pushing and what we're really trying to facilitate is a seat at the table, that we with people with spinal cord injuries have a meaningful role in the research enterprise. And it's not that anybody ever was trying to eliminate that. That just was the tradition of the way it was. But that is going to change. I promise you it's going to change. And it'll be a change that'll be good for the better. And frankly, I'm excited about what transforms really in the next 6 months. So stay tuned. There will be a spinal cord injury research advocacy course ready for people to enroll in, both researchers and people with spinal cord injuries, to really increase their knowledge in lay terms about how to understand and be actively involved in spinal cord research. And that's coming soon in the fall of 2022. So we're looking forward to that. And thank you for the opportunity of speaking about this today.
Good. Thank you so very much. We're not done with you yet, because my first question for the panel, and I have a few here that I've been recording, perhaps you've heard me clicking away on my keyboard, is for the panelists, and I'm seeing lots of questions come in, so I suspect I won't get through my own list, but I think my first question for you, Barry, is for you, and it also comes from a meeting that I had earlier today with the Canadian Brain Research Strategy, and we were talking about patient and affected person engagement, people with lived experience, I think we are seeing breakthroughs in engaging people with lived experience in the design and interpretation of results and dissemination of results to the larger community when it comes to human studies. But some of our researchers were questioning what the role and what the expertise is of a person with lived experience in a basic science experiment. Like, can you really understand anything at the table, and can you really meaningfully contribute? And I was wondering if you could speak to that for us.
Well, that is an excellent question, because in fact, in the work that we're doing right now in building this course, is that the input we're getting from the research side is not from clinicians so much as from basic researchers. And they've come to the table specifically to say it is very important, A, so they can understand it when it comes to the original design of what it is they're trying to prove, is that how would this help the person with spinal cord injury, period. And I'm sorry, as a funder, if you can't answer that question, get out of my office. I don't have time for it. 35 years in a wheelchair, I don't have time for it. Too many of my friends are gone because of the secondary complications. So that has to be a priority, number one, at least indirectly or directly down the road. Number two, it's a form of really empowerment too, and it helps somebody that's in a toiling in a lab one day wondering why they're doing all this. When they meet somebody and they meet some great people that are with lived experience that can give them that advice and talk to them, it really helps kind of energize them and bring more passion to the table. But you'd be surprised, when we're talking about design comes from the basic researchers at the very beginning. They don't get enough credit. They're the ones that come up with the concepts that see 10 chef's moves down the road. And so it's by that input from the very beginning of the day that we have a great influence. And I think it's very important at that point.
Right. Super. Thank you so much. I'm going to combine a question from the Q&A, and I am going to go out of order, and I do promise we will get to all the questions that have come in so far. So don't worry if your question is in first, but I'm not asking it first. But there's a question about what is the biggest reason that spinal cords can't repair themselves, like nerves in the hand mentioned by Dr. Faoud? And with that question, I would like to layer on another one, which is, how well do animal studies that are successful or even unsuccessful in demonstrating effectiveness translate to the human condition? So maybe Dr. Faoud, we can start with you, and then we'll let the others jump in for those that two-part question.
Yeah, so that gives me 15 more minutes, right? So why do they not grow? Well, it starts really with cleaning up at the injury site. In the peripheral nerve, basically, there's a highway outlined for neurons to grow on, and it remains intact. In the spinal cord, we basically end up with a cavitation, a hole, basically. And this is then sealed off with a kind of a brick wall from a certain cell type called astrocytes and fibroblasts. And so we basically have a wall and a hole, and neurons can't grow not through the wall and not through the hole. We need to kind of overcome that. The next reason is that even if they would make it, in the spinal cord, there are different cells than in the peripheral nerve that do this myelination. That means they wrap around axons and insulate them. And the cells in the spinal cord, interesting enough, they have molecules on top of them that are growth inhibitory. So when a neuron would come and grow along and hits one of those, it is like a punch in the face. They withdraw and they give up growing. So there are actually molecules in the spinal cord that stop growth actively. And the last thing I want to mention is that in the spinal cord, it looks like that the program for cells to grow has kind of been turned off or tuned down, which doesn't happen in the peripheral nervous system. So these are all factors that we have to consider when we try to build a reparative system or a platform like we try to do.
Okay, thank you. And perhaps the second part of the question is, how well do animal studies translate?
Yeah, it's a huge topic. It's massive. And this is a little bit my personal spin on it. I think, and I believe that animal models actually translate very well. The problem is that even in the animal model, we do not have a robust treatment yet. We don't, right? And so that's number one. So how can I translate something that is not very successful in the animal model? Well, we don't know. The issue is also that even from lab to lab, we have a hard time to replicate studies. That's proven. It has been done. People try to replicate very prominent studies, and they weren't doing so well. So the system is really complicated. And I think we're really not ready to say, oh, you know, it just doesn't translate because it's done in a rat or in mouse. It doesn't translate humans. I'm actually a strong believer it will. I'm very certain about that it will very well, but we haven't had something so robust in the animal model that we can compare it between labs and then do successful translation. So that's why I think we are struggling, and not because it's tested in animals.
All right, thank you. Yes, please.
John, just make a brief comment is also that as an engineer on this, I'm not an expert on the animal side, but I think all my colleagues would rather not have to use animals at all. The challenge is that this is such an extremely complex system that it's so far impossible to create an outside the animal or in vitro version of it. But that is part of our project. So we start actually in the lab, in using an artificial spinal cord to pre-screen our solutions and then move on to animals. The other thing that Wolf Tetzlaff, who's one of the leaders of the project, has told me many times is that you can look in the literature and see many people who have claimed to solve this problem, but often they are simply repairing two ends of the cord that are extremely close to each other to start with. And that's not the problem that we have here typically. It's, we're talking about bridging a gap that may be centimeters across. And that's a huge challenge. So thank you.
Thank you. Andrea?
And I was just going to add that the additional part that becomes hard when we're using animal models is the rehabilitation. You can do a certain amount of basic rehab, but it's not the same type of rehab that you may be able to do in humans. So it's just an extra layer that we're going to need to add in there that we may not be able to do to a full extent in an animal model.
Okay. Oh, Karim, certainly. No, you're on mute.
I just would like to add to this. I totally agree, right? We realize that if you don't have this component of rehabilitation training in there that we can do in humans, we will most likely not translate the effect of any growth promoting treatment. So it is part of a combined package, and we really adding this, and I'm promoting this also big time, that it is part of any treatment, has to be, you know, at least as close as possible to what we do in humans.
Nice, thank you. I want to continue on this thread a little bit, but before I do that, I want to give a shout out to Anita Kaiser, who is a member of our Ethics and KT Council, who writes in the chat, people with lived experience can help basic scientists see the big picture, streamline their objective, and give greater meaning and purpose to the work they do. I couldn't agree with you more. Ashley Lawson on my team and Canadian Brain Research Strategy, if you could please take note of that. I think that's something we want to feedback to the national strategy that we're developing for brain research today. Going back to the sort of some scientific questions, we have a question from Susanna Brooke, who's a member of the NEST Lab under the direction of Dr. Julie Robillard as part of Neuroethics Canada, who queries whether how acute and chronic injuries influence these questions of regeneration. How do we think about individuals in different timelines on the recovery trajectory in terms of patient recruitment and participation? And the floor is open to any of you to respond.
Okay, I guess I start. First of all, it's an excellent question. Second of all, I'm not very proud how the field has handled this for the longest time, because for the longest time, people did research in acute models because it's quicker. And I think this is a wonderful example where, you know, the feedback from the community, from people living with spinal cord injury came in and said, look, the majority of us live with this chronic injury. How does that affect us? And as researchers, we really, it was, let's say not eye-opening, but it was a little bit embarrassing for me to say, yeah, we need to look at this better. Is the system different? Absolutely. In the acute system, the nervous system is still more adaptive than in the chronic. But we also realize now that maybe we can recreate this acute system. We start to understand it also with the new technology available to us. We start to understand what the difference is between acute and chronic. And by the way, if you ask anyone, nobody will probably agree on what the term acute and chronic means in the first place. So we need to define those very clearly on what are we basing this acute and chronic. And we can start to learn the different time courses on the transition. And even now we can learn, how does this compare between animals and humans? And we learn so much more about how to then really apply these treatments in people with different age, with different chronicity of the injury, and so on. So it's underexplored, that's for sure. But yes, there are big differences, and we are getting there.
Thank you.
I want to jump in.
Yeah.
Bridget, I was listening. That is a good question. It's funny. I can guarantee that of the 68 people on this call right now, and of those who have a spinal cord injury, none of them are acute. Okay. What is their priority? Okay. that's the point. And that's why we ask these questions. And I'll even go a little cynical and say sometimes people want to do the acute, like Karim had perfectly laid out the differences and why, what an acute injury can potentially do with the potential of recovery. It's considered a more of a low hanging fruit and a potential better numbers and a win. There's also another argument too, that if you can find something restorative and acute, there might be a good chance that that same treatment would work in someone with chronic as well. So the problem is that we have is, how do you know after 5 days, 5 weeks, 5 months, if their recovery is a result of the treatment that was given, or it was just a natural recovery that happens in many people with spinal cord injuries? And that's where we have a problem. And on top of that, recruitment for acute is very difficult, especially if the window is short and that you only have 48, 72 hours. Just getting informed consent on a new therapy is highly questionable on whether it's valid or not. So there's a lot of challenges here, but I know everybody's working hard to get to that point.
I can just say this is a huge consideration in our project. I think we've pretty much decided that there's no way that we can give a totally new treatment to somebody within 24 or 48 hours of injury, or it's very unlikely. So we're probably looking initially at least sort of 30 days or so before. But that's a really open question. And then how does what we learn translate to those who have had a longer term injury, and does it? So these are really important questions.
Indeed, I'll just jump in and say, under funding from the Stem Cell Network many years ago, my team and I showed some really profound effects from the perspectives of people with acute and chronic injuries, and also different levels of injury in terms of what would constitute an appropriate time to seek participation in a clinical trial. And we were in fact quite wrong in predicting that those with cervical injuries would be the most anxious to participate. And in fact, we found that they were the most risk averse, really cautious of losing any sort of residual function whatsoever. Those who were further out and had more residual function were more likely to be interested in participating in a clinical trial that involves stem cells anyway. So much work to be done. There's a question that from Anita on sex differences in recovery based on animal models. And in fact, the question of sex differences and inclusion criteria around marginalized populations and so forth is one that I also had. And I think it's a nice a segue from what we've just been talking about. Maybe Andrea, can you speak to gender differences and sex differences in spinal cord injury, recovery patterns that might pertain to differences? And then we can also think about what research looks like in terms of inclusivity.
So I can mention a couple of things. One is we have our traditional, what we think of as our stereotypical spinal cord injured individual. And traditionally that was a young male, 18 to 35, high risk behavior. But what we've seen, and that ratio was generally sort of 4 to 1, men to women were injured. But what we now see is that we actually have a bimodal distribution. So we've got one group of younger patients who do still tend to be more men than women. And then we have an older population group where it's not as high an impact. It's not as what we call a high impact injury. It may simply be a fall. And because of degenerative changes in the spine, they get a traumatic spinal cord injury. And that's much more of a 50-50 picture in terms of gender. So just in terms of who gets spinal cord injuries, we've got sort of two populations. In terms of recovery and natural history, I don't think there's much of a difference, not that I'm aware of. And then the other thing is we've been talking a lot about traumatic spinal cord injury. So traumatic spinal cord injury is is due to trauma. So it's what we typically think of for spinal cord injury, a car accident, a sporting accident, violence, falls. But often, you know, 50% of the spinal cord injuries we see are non-traumatic. So they may be due to a stroke or a vascular event or an infection or a bleed. So there's lots of other reasons to have spinal cord injuries. And again, those often tend to be more, or cancer or tumor, those tend to be more 50-50 with men and women impacted.
All right, thank you. Other comments on enrollment criteria, inclusivity, sex differences in the space? No? Okay, then let's carry on in this thread. There seems to be some interest in the chat around some clinical trials. I believe that NerveGen, a company called NerveGen, is conducting. Maybe Dr. Madden, you could speak a little bit to that trial and why it's of interest to Mend the Gap. I'm just going to note that none of us, to my knowledge, have a conflict of interest with any devices or pharmacologics that are being tested in this space. And if you do and wish to declare it, we would appreciate it. Dr. Madden, over to you.
So I'll pass it over to Kareem shortly because he has a better knowledge of this, but I guess there are a number of different, there are a number of companies and a number of labs that are looking at alternative methods to promote regeneration in the spinal cord. I would say that none are as quite as comprehensive, but there are lots of promising approaches. One of them, which is not what NerveGen are looking at, but is to create a sort of a scaffold that it gets inserted into the injury site and contains little tubes along which axons can grow. And so there are clinical trials going on with that at the moment. We await to see how successful they've been. One of the concerns that we have with that is that it is more invasive. So it's not a needle-driven approach. And there are a lot of drug treatments and other treatments that people are looking at. And one of the interesting approaches is one that NerveGen has produced. And I'll let Kareem maybe speak to that. And I'll just say that we are interested in what they're doing. And look forward to seeing how it turns out. So I'll turn it over to Kareem.
Yeah, I think I can take it a step further, John. We're not just interested, we're actually working with them. And obviously I have a non-disclosure agreement and I really don't want to go into too much details here, but we are working with them and it's a very good collaboration. And we just basically started the experiment. And really what it's based on, it's again, one of these factors I mentioned that inhibit neurons from growing. And NerveGen has a target that we could basically try to neutralize and promote then growth of nerve cells. So that is a collaboration with them. They're trying obviously also different injuries and diseases of the nervous system, but for spinal injury, we have a very good collaboration going right now.
Thank you. Any other comments on that? I think Barry put the link to the trial in the chat. Is that right?
Yeah.
Did that come through?
There's a couple search engines out there now, but we really promote the seitrials.org. And it really helps people identify if they're interested in any kind of clinical trials anywhere in the world. It's all in lay terms and they can set up their own profile. And many companies now that are in the recruitment stage of any type of clinical trial are using this one as well as a few others. So they're looking for that connection between people recruiting and people wanting to be involved in trials. So please try it out and go through it and set up a profile. You might find it interesting and helpful.
Yeah. Barry, can you comment, is the US-based clinicaltrials.gov also a good resource of information for people seeking clinical trials?
Yeah, and actually seitrials.org does feed off of clinicaltrials.gov. So it's been a quote a government approved trial. I understand right now that the government, the US clinicaltrials.gov is now going into a beta change. They want to change it. It's a little archaic. It's not the easiest site to go through. That's why I suggested scitrials.org. But stay tuned. I think there is some changes coming to that site, that search engine as well.
All right. Thank you. If somebody could just type clinicaltrials.gov into the chat for those who wish to have it decoded, I'd appreciate that. Thank you. So I'm going to go all the way to the top of my chat stream. I'm tracking a lot of things with great pleasure here. A question that came in to me directly, and so I won't share the name of the individual, who recently listened to a TED Daily talk from last week, and it was about control of digital devices. This device, it appears, as a brain-computer interface that's designed to assist people with ALS to communicate their thoughts and then their desires and wishes. I've done a lot of work in this space as well. It is both powerful technology and technology that is still evolving. Our participant asks whether there's a potential for such a BCI interface, a brain-computer interface, to assist individuals with spinal cord injury. What has been done in that area, and is there something we should be looking forward to coming out of the laboratories who are working in the BCI space?
The answer is yeah. It's actually a lot of activity in that area right now, and there's a few competing companies. Neuralink, you've heard of, a certain gentleman named Elon Musk is the principal of. BlackRock and others, there's work in this area, because it's also not just spinal cord injury. It really deals with so many different conditions that it could help potentially.
Thanks, Barry. Other comments on the BCIs, and then I will actually have a comment.
I'll just mention briefly that in a way, this is an alternative approach to what Mend the Gap is looking at. So can you hear me okay? In the ultimate version of that, you would imagine reading signals above the injury and then passing them back down below the injury, and creating a sort of a digital communication between the upper and lower areas. Now, that's still a ways away. At the moment, and Kareem can correct me if I'm wrong, but we're talking about maybe 16 electrodes being read, or maybe 128, or relatively small numbers of electrodes. But there's the other area that where Mend the Gap is sort of on a parallel track, is looking at ways of using electrical stimulation in helping with rehabilitation. So it turns out, you've probably seen in the news with some of the Broncos hockey players who have received spinal cord injury using electrical stimulation and so on. So that's an area where we will be needing to go in order to help with recovery. And I'll turn it over to Kareem in case he has any additional comments.
Yeah, I mean, the field is huge. Let's face it, and there are various levels that you could apply it. But I'm very impressed already for a couple of years, it has been shown that the very low number of electrodes put into the cortex, artificial robotic arms could be controlled, and fairly precise, actually. So that is definitely something to look at. There are many challenges, obviously, with that. If you put something into the brain of a person, that is a critical thing. And biomaterials, for example, they don't last forever. I don't know, John, you can comment on that again. But I know when I was visiting Pittsburgh, who was very advanced in this research, they said, well, the insulation is going to fall apart after 15 years. So, you cannot put this into a person of 25 years. You have to exchange everything in the cortex. You might do more damage. You might get inflammation. It is a complex topic around, how compatible are we? And so the less invasive you would be, probably the better that is, but it has a lot of future. And even if it's just the neuromodulation, right, you don't have to feed into every muscle and control it. You could feed it back into the spinal cord and just increase excitability of circuitry at the point when it's needed. And that could just give the extra boost, right? It doesn't have to be the complete control of the body. It could just be a little bit of a booster to help whatever is remaining in the spinal cord to actually execute the task. So it's a very excited field. It's promising for sure.
So just to follow up briefly on some of the materials challenges. So you can imagine if you have some of the original electrodes are made of metal, not surprisingly. And you can imagine if you have something as stiff as a metal in the really soft material that makes up the brain and the central nervous system, the spinal cord, there are stresses that then lead to sort of an encapsulation by the body of those electrodes. And so gradually you lose the electrical connection. There can also be immune responses and so on. So this is a problem that people are working on really actively to try and create the right materials to interface with the electrodes. And that includes using, in some cases, plastics or polymers that are much softer and also are able to exchange ions and not just electrons. And then create an interface that's much more like a natural interface. Our electronics operate at, 3 volts, 5 volts, 15 volts, whereas the electrical potentials across our cells are more like tens or, 70 millivolts or so. So there's a big difference in the electrical properties of our electronic devices, and people are learning how to overcome these challenges, and there's been a lot of success lately. So it is a very promising area. Okay. And by the way, we're looking to hire somebody, a Canada Excellence Research Chair in neuroprosthetics in exactly this area to complement our other work. So if you know of people, June 15th is when we need the application by. So,
all right. Thank you for that commercial. So I'm going to make another commercial. As somebody who's particularly interested in the ethics of innovations for neuroscience, I just want to point out to our audience that when, as researchers, we have funded grants from the government, we are required to have ethics oversight from our institutions and even from the bodies that fund us that have their own ethics offices and regimes. Organizations or companies like Neuralink that are truly private have no ethics oversight per se, or are not required to have ethics oversight per se. And so we as an ethics group are very interested in keeping an eye on what organizations like Neuralink or Stent Road are doing, working with these companies to help ensure the highest standards of research ethics conduct is really being undertaken. We do know that Neuralink recently posted, they're in competition with you potentially, John, for a clinical trials coordinator, which would suggest to anyone that they're trying to embark on clinical trials. And it's of great interest to us how they're really undertaking the highest standards of ethics in what they're doing. I'm sure their intentions are good, but boots on the ground are pretty important. And with that, I'd like to ask Andrea Townsend, if you have a patient who says, Dr. Townsend, I want to enroll in this clinical trial that's going to put 16 or 8 or 4 electrodes in my brain, what are the factors? What do you advise, and what are the factors that your patients should be thinking about before jumping too fast on that wagon?
Yeah, I this is a dilemma for me. This one it's truly a dilemma for me. I don't have a lot of experience with brain implants. Spinal cord stimulators, we've been using those. I have experience with those because we've been using those for pain for a long time. So spinal cord stimulators, we've been using those for pain. Those are devices that have been used for that, epidural stimulators, and now are being sort of repurposed and advanced and used for a different reason, for neuromodulation and to see if we can get some recovery and regenerate happening. But we do see complications with them, right? We do see complications. Leads break, leads erode, batteries need replacing. But, you know, there's things that happen with when we have devices that are implanted, and there's many different devices that we work with on a regular basis. So I always talk to patients about how to investigate whether what they're doing is a true study. So I talk to them about some of the resources. So some of the resources, like the I send them to clinicaltrials.gov. I send them to scitrials.org. I ask them to talk to us as clinicians if they are thinking about enrolling or engaging in a study. Is it really a study? Are they having to pay money? Or is it a study? Like, what are the incentives? What are the disincentives? What is the follow-up involved? Do they have to travel somewhere? Do they have to stay somewhere for rehab after they have something implanted? Because these are all very practical factors, let alone the actual technology itself and what's involved. But yeah, it's interesting because these are difficult questions to answer.
Is there a way of evaluating, oh gosh, I don't even know how to say this in a correct way, the authenticity of a clinical trial? Like who it's being run by, who the company is, what other work they've done and so forth. Are these on the websites? Like are they registered as a clinical trial, for example?
Well, that's a good question. I'd like to just start that. As someone says, a spinal cord, and people are asking me all the time, I give out the following criteria. First of all, when you're talking about the science itself, has it been peer reviewed? That's number one. Because if it's a treatment of some sort that has not been published by and looked at by its peers, that is a huge warning sign. In fact, and stay away from medical tourism. Frankly, I got to tell you that right now. Why? And by the way, this goes back from the beginning of time. For some reason, when we have our injuries, we can't accept that there's certain things just haven't been created or found yet or discovered. So we have this idea that in some backwoods lab, either behind the old Soviet Union or in Mexico somewhere or Peru, and we bring in shark fin and everything else, that somehow, some way, that's the answer because they read about it somewhere. Or here's the worst part. If you're paying for it, not a good thing. Those are warning signs that it's not necessarily an approved clinical trial that could have actual efficacy that could help somebody. It's kind of known as what we call medical tourism.
All right, thank you. Those tips are really important. That your questions are now getting ahead of me, which is very exciting, but very daunting for me. So I'm going to move on to another question that came in early in this conversation about nutritional supplements. Can nutritional supplements help with neuroscarring, tide people over between treatments? Do you have, again, we're not offering clinical advice here in this conversation, but perhaps insights and experience that would be valuable in addressing this very interesting question. Does somebody wish to take on supplements?
I can't really answer that, I'm afraid, but I do know we have some experts, including Ward Plunett, who's on the call here, I think, and Wolf Tetzlaff. So there is a lot of work trying to relate injury to diet and so on. I'm just not an expert in that area. So,
okay. I can maybe comment a little bit on it. Because inflammation is a big part of a spinal cord injury acutely, but also in the recovery process, nutrition can influence inflammation quite a bit. And this now also comes then with the gut microbiome, which also is changing after spinal cord injury. And there have been some relatively dramatic effects on recovery. And we're not just talking motor recovery. We're talking, for example, also mental health. So Yes, I think there are factors in nutrition that we can influence, very simple influence them. I think there's a big trend in research now too, to say, let's do things that we can actually relatively easily do and address and have small gains with them. And then maybe, you know, we can add them all together to a platform like we do now with Mend the Gap. The problem is, how do you do research when you have so many factors and you throw them together? You need to control for them. You need to compare things. And this is what makes it very hard. But I think, yes, they have a big future. And there are many researchers now looking at that. And, you know, maybe they just add a little bit here or there. But there's something that we can and we will see in the future much more.
All right. Thank you. All right, I'm going to go on to a pair of questions now that I'm going to take the liberty of assembling. And there's a question about comorbidities, loss of bone, arthritis, and maybe, you know, multi-level injuries. How do these combine or conspire to affect good outcomes in the research and in eventually quality of life? And what does success really look like, I'll say, by itself or in the face of multi-level injury or comorbidities?
Should I tackle comorbidities? I'll tackle comorbidities.
Thanks. I think you're the best for that.
Pardon me?
You're probably the most suited to answer that one.
So, I mean, one of the things we know, and one of the things that Barry alluded to as well, is all the secondary complications we get from spinal cord injury. So that ranges from increased risk of metabolic syndrome, and metabolic syndrome is, you know, early onset diabetes, cardiovascular health, hyperlipidemia or high cholesterol. So these are all things that we see in spinal cord injury. Osteoporosis is something that we see significantly below the level of the injury, particularly in people who have motor complete injuries. So people who don't have motor movement below the level of their injury. And we see that osteoporosis very quickly, and it's very substantial. So it happens within, you know, within days, people start to have bone turnover. And then within months, they've had significant bone density loss. So there is always that risk of people having low bone density and an increased risk of breaking a bone below the level of the injury. But, and this is a big but we still stand people up many years after their injury in a standing frame or in, and they don't just crumble. People don't just crumble. But we have to be careful if we're suddenly going to apply a force to those bones. So the difference between standing somebody up passively, where they're just standing up and being supported, versus somebody standing up because their muscle is suddenly pulling on a bone, is something we're going to have to think about. And so for people living with spinal cord injury, it's maintaining their nutrition as much as they can. And, you know, bone density, obviously, it depends on much more than, but we were just talking about supplements. So making sure you get your vitamin D and all those good calcium and all those good things. But it's also maintaining your range of motion as much as you can so that you don't have contractures, you haven't lost range of motion. And trying to maintain those pieces as much as possible. But it is something we're going to need to think about in people who have been living with chronic spinal cord injury.
Right. Anyone else weighing in on this? Okay, I'm going to again call out Anita Kaiser, who, you know, reinforces to all of us that exercise, good health behaviors are essential to well-being and indeed for benefiting from anything new that comes down the pipeline, right? If we approach something from a position of strength, behavioral and physical strength, we're most likely to benefit. I'm going to do another land assembly here. For those of you in Vancouver, you know what I'm talking about. We're like assembling land all over our city. And this has to do with inclusivity and recruitment. And it's a question that's posed both by Adam Fraser, who's the executive director of Mend the Gap, and another audience participant, which really speaks to what are the challenges to recruiting people from all backgrounds to a project like Mend the Gap, to other kinds of spinal cord injury research? What methods work? What methods don't work? And what should we attend to when it comes to participant enrollment and recruitment? Karim, and then I'm going to also ask Barry to weigh in.
Yeah, I just want to start because when we start from a basic research aspect, when it comes to translation, the clinical trial, we have to be careful what we're looking at from basic research, what we're taking to the clinic, because some treatments are effective in a certain lesion model and they would not do anything in another. And I experienced this. We did research in a certain model. It was taken into the clinic. And then, everyone was recruited and then it didn't work out. And there are examples of that. So I think the first step when we talk about recruitment, which many clinicians might not even look at in detail, but what model did this work? And if it worked in that model, do we need then to consider this for the recruitment of the trial or the first set of trials, at least, to get a promising finding? Because it's a big consideration that gets neglected very frequently.
I want to speak to Karim. You touched on something that's basically talking about the different models. Like there's currently a big, I'm not saying a debate, but there's a big discussion on how we can really get out of the typical mouse model that works great, but doesn't work in the human. How do we bridge that gap? That's number one. And that's a big discussion. But one thing is interesting that we must remember, and this is part of a course I keep we're building right now, so it's easy off the top of my head. But one of the biggest differences between spinal cord injury and a lot of other even neurological conditions that were very heterogeneous, that you could have 100 spinal cord injuries in a room and have 100 different implications of how that injury needs to be treated or how it would respond to something. Not like, say, an MS study where, you're dealing with certain more homogeneous type things. So, and when I say heterogeneous, we're all different, much different than most other conditions when it compares to each other. So that's a task for scientists and clinicians, is how do we try to get together something that might help a group of people as opposed to a one-off.
And I'll just want to say that for the Mend the Gap project, we are at least 6 years away from having starting a clinical trial. So and deciding on these questions, we're already trying to think about how we would do that if we are successful. But it is a huge challenge. Really this project is a moonshot. So it's really a huge, very highly ambitious, big project. We think we know what pieces we need to put together, but we're not ready yet to take it to a human. When it comes to this idea of mouse or rat models, one of the issues, as I understand it, is just the scale is so small compared to the human. And so we need to go up the scale before we get to trials in humans. And so that's another challenge. When we come to the diversity, there is often a common issue, which is the wound and treating the wound site and the sort of breaking of the connection and the restoring of the connection. And that's really what this project, the Mend the Gap project, is aimed at, which then hopefully can help with the myriad of other complications that come along with spinal cord injury. And just to give some numbers, I think some people on the call know these numbers better, but individuals with SCI, it's common for the lifetime cost to be $3 to $6 million. So beyond the huge impact on the quality of life, there's also a huge cost associated with it. And that total cost can be similar to the cost of all cancers. So not, it, you know, maybe about a third the costs of all cancer. So if we can make an impact, have an impact, or even make some modest advances, what we hope is to have to be able to help people, individuals with SCI through basic tasks in their daily lives, and be able to alleviate the healthcare system. So that's really sort of the context that we're talking about. Thank you.
Thank you. So we see in the chat, John, your answer about non-traumatic injury, which is not a target for the Mend the Gap approach. But could you just elaborate a little bit from your chat response about the size of the injury in the microtubules? And then I would like to ask you if you could comment on prospects for children with spinal cord injury. We haven't talked about them at all in this conversation yet.
So I'm already, as the engineer on the call, I'm already treading onto thin ice, but maybe Karim and others can correct me if I get it wrong. But so when there's a traumatic injury, there's typically one or more specific sites where, you know, there's a clear loss of connection, a wound, and our approach is to try and treat that wounded area and create a kind of a set of breadcrumbs that the axons can follow to create some, hopefully, reconnection, some restoration of function, which may not be, it could be improved hand function, it could be restoration of bladder function, sexual function, other things, you know, help with blood pressure regulation, perspiration, sweating, et cetera. So any of those things would be a huge advance if we could do that. The size, from my crude engineering understanding, shouldn't be an obstacle in the sense that what we're doing is injecting a gel that should fill the injury, and then of whatever size it is, and then we apply the magnetic field and help with the regrowth. For non-traumatic injury, I don't have a good understanding of the mechanisms there. What I have heard from my colleagues, from Wolf Tetzlaff and others, is that the mechanisms are sufficiently different that it's unlikely that our treatment will be relevant. But I'll defer to others to comment more on that.
And the question of children.
And for children, again, I'll just give my engineer's answer, which is that, like with vaccines, I think that will be later in the process, but I don't know if there's any fundamental reason why it would not be possible.
All right, thank you. Other comments on this question? No? Okay. So I actually am coming to the last question in the queue that I have before me, but we're also coming to the end of the hour. And I'd appreciate if everyone could really speak to this question. And I'll preface it by saying that with the work that my team and I did with Brian Kwan and Wolf Tetzlaff and others on stem cells and spinal cord injury repair, we often found that the perspectives and priorities and values of clinicians and researchers were very different from those of people affected with a condition, where physicians and researchers tend to have very discrete endpoints, like clinically meaningful endpoints and infection and so forth. And the viewpoint of people with the lived experience were really far more holistic. Around quality of life, but not only for themselves, but around for their families and the whole networks around them. So I'm going to ask as a last question, how do we reconcile, or how do we seek convergence between clinical endpoints and quality of life, especially as we've discussed spinal cord injury can be very different from one person to the other? And how do we really identify that sweet spot or sweet spots that we can really say gave us success or give us success? And maybe Barry, we could start with you.
I think the idea of bringing together on convergence is the perfect point, that we all need to be at the same table. And then with more dialogue, you won't have people thinking that they're doing the right thing or helping somebody else without the people that want to be helped say, this is what we want. And that's where the connection will be had. That's where priorities will be set. Many don't know this, but when we did our recent, there's the famous Anderson paper of 2004. And then of course, what we did as a snapshot back before the NIH meetings was we asked the community and we had 1800 respondents, you know, what's a priority in research for you? Well, mobility was fifth. Okay. Bowel, bladder, pain, sexual function. These things are more important to our community right now. Now, does it take restorative treatment for some of them? Yes, it does. And so that all said, I'm sorry, it's a little long-winded, but the people with lived experience need to be talking with the researchers and the clinicians together at the same time to come to that point. And I think that's how you can really let it dictate itself that way.
All right. Thank you, Barry. So well stated. John?
So this getting everybody together is exactly what we want to do. And, you know, what Barry has stated is the ideal. And Judy, along with Rick Hansen, are leading our ethics and knowledge translation committee. Andrea is involved in that too. But it's still a challenge because we have this committee, then we need to make sure that information really gets disseminated through to all of the team. So this is a challenge that we're living at the moment and trying to find the best way of implementing it. And some of the people on the call are involved in making sure that we spread that message. And we've had tremendous support from Praxis, from SCIBC, from Barry and others. And we're just going to keep making sure that we keep as scientists and engineers, we keep checking back that we're doing the right thing and solving the right problem and for the right reason, which is critical.
Yeah. And it also speaks to the upfront integration of on the ground perspectives and priorities right at the beginning of the science and the conceptualization of the scientific process. Kareem, over to you, and we'll end with a comment from Andrea.
I totally agree, but I also have to defend a little bit the researcher. We talk about motor functions not that important. The thing is that many researchers and the history, again, we can look back. Why do we look at locomotion? Because it's easy to study, right? If I do a screening for a treatment in a rat model, for example, it is much easier to study how the leg moves than to say, how's the mental health? Or how is the gut or sexual function in the animal, right? That it is a matter of simplicity sometimes, and you start with that. Do we have to move on when we say, oh yeah, this is a treatment that helps with motor function, to go and really look comprehensively at what does that treatment do? Super important, because we have to keep in mind that we have so many systems in our body, and the treatment could actually be beneficial to one and very negative to the other. And I'm talking here about pain versus motor function, because many treatments that would help to promote a motor recovery have a good chance to actually increase pain. So yes, we have to be comprehensive, and yes, we have to understand what the real problem of people actually are. But in the beginning, in the screening, in the basic research, it is easier to go and test more things in a simple model of motor function.
All right. Thank you, Kareem. Andrew Townsend, I'm going to give you the last word.
I couldn't agree more with Kareem in terms of in defense of some of the things that have happened, is that the things that are easy to measure are the things that are easy to measure. And so whenever it's patient reported or quality of life, it can be a little bit harder to measure, but we do have ways to measure that. And one of the things we use a lot in rehabilitation is something called a goal attainment scale. And so that is something where the patient themselves there's an individual goal, and we see whether this intervention helps them achieve that goal. And so I think it takes us back to what I said at the very beginning, I'll come first full circles, that we're going to end up with an individualized, personalized approach to our interventions down the road. Maybe not when, you know, as we're doing studies, we may have, that may not be, but as we start to implement this and really integrate this into patient care, we're going to have to look at that those individual priorities along with the group's priorities. So.